Good morning and thank you for being here today. I hope that all of you are considering your opportunity to send a note of encouragement and welcome to your new preacher. That information has been provided for you in the bulletin, their name and address and how you make a contact. I know in this day and age, perhaps sending a letter or a card is not as up-to-date as sending an email, so you can do that as well. Do what you can to welcome this new family. Jim McGuigan speaks of a boyhood acquaintance whose name was David. 2 years ahead of him in school, he would write in one of his books, "By the time we entered the sixth grade, everyone idolized David. He was robust, of sturdy build. He was a good-looking fellow." McGuigan would say, "So great in school that all of the girls just swooned over him." And he said, "All of us little guys idolized him and longed to be like him. The last thing that we saw of him as he graduated and went off was that he was headed off to the university with a good scholarship." This particular writing, McGuigan would say, that was about 35 years ago. Jim McGuigan, who has worked in Ireland, said, "About 5 years ago, we returned to Belfast to do some work, and I was driving, and I turned down a particular street, and I made a wrong turn, and so I had to double back and go through an alleyway to get back to the street I was supposed to be on, and I was whisking down that alley thinking no one would be there, and I was in a hurry needing to be someplace." He said, "All of a sudden, there was just a man, just a drunken bum, who fell out of the doorway in the alley right in front of my car. I almost killed everyone with me and the man, swerving to try and miss him. He just grazed him and knocked him off of his feet, jammed his car into a little embankment there in the alleyway. And he said, when I looked around in the car and I realized that all of us were okay, then I jumped out to see if I could help the man that we had hit. He was already on his feet, and when McGuigan started toward him, he began to just sort of wave this clutched fist at him, holding in it a dirty bottle and just waving it back and forth. McGuigan said, he glared at me, and I said to him, 'Sir, I am so sorry. Are you okay?' He didn't say a word, just glared into my eyes and I into his." He would write, "From that moment of our eyes meeting, I recognized him. It was David." And I've often thought about that scene. I've often just shrugged my shoulders and wondered, how'd that happen? How in the world did that happen? I don't know. He just didn't make it. Chuck Swindoll tells the story of a man in the Bowery in New York City, that flop house where you could stay the night for 25 cents. You could get a cup of coffee the next morning for a dime. And he said there was a man who was there on this particular night who came down the stairs in the middle of the night to wash his face in a porcelain basin that was set there for all of the tenants to use. And the man washed his face, and in the process of washing his face, he dripped some of the water onto the floor, slipped in the water, and as he fell, he hit the basin. It fell over and shattered, and somehow, as the man fell, he landed on a piece of that shattered porcelain basin, gashed his head, and they found him the next morning in a pool of blood, very dead. The coroner came and they loaded the body and they took him to Bellevue Hospital, stitched up the wound with just some old ordinary black thread. And he said all that they could find on his person of his belongings was 37 cents, obviously for a night's lodging there in the Bowery and a cup of coffee in the morning. They also found two lines of a song on a little torn out piece of paper. It was the lyric that puzzled them. There was no identity, and literally for about 2 weeks he lay there in the morgue, an unidentified bum from the Bowery. And wasn't that what they all were down at the Bowery, just bums? Until about 2 weeks later, a distant relative came and claimed and identified the body of Stephen J. Foster, a man who had written and published literally hundreds of songs. Songs like "Oh, Susanna," "My Old Kentucky Home," 200 other songs written and published by this great writer. How did that happen? How in the world did he arrive at that point, at that station in his life? Someone just shrugs and says, "I don't know. Don't know all the circumstances. Don't know all of the situations that brought him to that place. Just didn't make it." And so we began this discussion last Sunday about the fact that there are millions of people just like those two that we've talked about this morning all around the world, probably thousands in your own community, who for some reason or another have just never found the power in their lives to see it through, have never been able to make it through this life that God has given them, through the task of living their lives, the task that lies in front of each of us. Somehow they've never found in Jesus Christ the grace that's needed to make it through their marriage, the power that they need to sustain them and to make it through a relationship that seems so difficult. And many of them we talked about and discussed are just beaten. They're just worn out. They're just worn down by the inequities of their lives, the pain that they suffer day after week, after month, after year. And they just live their entire lives this way until one day, uneventfully, their life is just finally over. And others, we said as we continued our discussion, are beaten and are worn down and worn out by their struggle against sin, because they thought, and Christianity was presented to them in such a way, that there would be one good hard battle against sin and they'd be done with it. It would all be over, and the rest of their lives would be a fairy tale ending, only to find themselves engaged in a lifetime of trench warfare against this struggle that we call sin. Beaten down and discouraged because they really don't think that God could care for them anyway. And we talked about the fact that there are a lot of people in religion today that are just, frankly, bored powerless and bored listless with the Christ that they are hearing presented, bored by the lack of relevance of the gospel message that they are hearing from pulpits around our world, bored by the lack of challenge that they see in the Christ that is being presented to them. And so we began to ask the question, where do you find the power to see it through? Where do you find the power to live this life successfully, to make it in this physical journey and exist of us from the beginning point to the ending point? Where do you find that? And I'd like to narrow that question and narrow its answer this morning by saying to you simply that people find the power to see it through by enjoying and experiencing redemptive relationships. People find the power to see it through their lives, to make it through the task of life and living this life and the relationships that are difficult and the marriages that don't seem to work. And yes, even through their struggle against sin, even in the midst of a religion that oftentimes is less than what God intended it to be, people find the power to see it through in redemptive relationships. The last letter the old man wrote was 2 Timothy. If you have your Bibles this morning, that's a hint, by the way. Would you just turn and look at that letter for just a moment? And if you read the letter of 2 Timothy very carefully, you can develop from within it four or five major themes. But there is one overriding theme. There is one very prominent theme in this little letter of 2 Timothy. It's this theme of redemptive relationships. The older man, Paul, writes to the younger man, to that boy to whom he is especially related, and he talks to and he talks about the young man Timothy. And he goes on to say there, if you're looking in chapter 1 and verse 5, I am reminded, Timothy, it's ever present in my mind, the sincere faith that first lived in your grandmother, Lois, and also in your mother, Eunice. Before you just read that and quickly dismiss it, could I tell you, therein is where you find a secret that gives power to all of us to see it through in our lives. Paul says, I can look back in your life, Timothy, and I can find someone who held on to you and would not let you go, and from whom you received something important that you would not have received had it not been for these people. In your case, for you, it happens to be your mother. It happens to be your grandmother. James Dobson, in one of his books, writes of asking a group of school-aged children, how would you describe your grandmother? Just write a few sentences. How would you describe your grandmother? And one little boy in the class wrote, grandmothers, well, they're fat, but not too fat where they can't bend down to tie your shoestrings. They wear glasses. Sometimes they can reach in and take out their teeth. They can answer all the questions about why dogs hate cats and why God isn't married. And when they take you for walks, they don't keep saying, hurry up, hurry up. They let you stop and look at things you want to look at. If they read you a story, they don't skip places, even if they've read it to you before. Dobson concludes by saying, everybody ought to have a grandmother, because grandmothers are the only grown-ups who have time. You see, it was a grandmother who took a boy by the name of Timothy on her knee and taught him the way of God, taught him the will and the word of God, taught him about the love of God. It was a mother by the name of Eunice who took hold of a boy by the name of Timothy and held on to him all the days of his life and taught him the ways of God. If you're still in that chapter, a little later in that chapter, if you would look at verse 15, you'll see Paul, as he speaks painfully of Phygellus and Hermogenes and how they have deserted him. And then he'll turn lovingly and joyfully and say, may the Lord show mercy to the household of Onesiphorus, because he has often refreshed me and he has not been ashamed of my chains. You also recall that he goes on in the book of 2 Timothy and talks about, get Mark, bring Mark with you to me. And he implies in that Barnabas. You remember Barnabas? The story of Paul and Barnabas, don't you? Barnabas was the one who finally gave Paul a break when no one else in the world would give him a break. In fact, everyone else believed he did not deserve a break. Same one gave John Mark a break, even when Paul wouldn't give him one. And you remember that infamous argument, don't you? We are taking Mark with us on this trip, you know, Paul. No, we're not, Barnabas. We are not taking him. Paul, we are taking the boy. He needs to go with us. We are not taking him. Paul, I said, we're taking him. And I said, Paul, it's either him or me. And Barnabas said, well, then it'll be him. I'm going with the boy. And now so much later in his life, Paul is saying, get Mark for me. So helpful. Please bring him to me. Friends, do you know how people finish the course? Do you know how they finish the race? Do you know how they fight the good fight all the way to the end? Which, by the way, are some more words that Paul will speak in just a moment as you are going forward in this text. They fight it first and foremost and forever in the presence of redemptive relationships. Somebody gets a hold of them and will not let them go. Who was that for you in your life? Who was it in your life who latched onto you in loyalty and in love and would never leave you alone? Who always insisted on believing in you? Who always insisted on being loyal to you, even on the days when you knew you did not deserve their loyalty, even when you knew you were not worthy of their belief? William Grenfell was a doctor of years ago, practiced his medicine in places like Labrador and Greenland. He was in the hospital one afternoon, and the medics rolled in a woman who was dying on a stretcher. Will write in his memoirs, her husband was not a good man. He had come home one day in a drunken rage, and he was angry at her, and for some reason he picked up and he threw a burning kerosene lamp at her. She ducked, but it exploded on the wall behind her, drenched her in that flammable liquid and caught her in the flames. And Grenfell writes in his memoirs, I can still see that miserable creature standing at the foot of her bed between the policemen, watching every movement of his dying wife. I can see to this very day the magistrate stooping over the bed and warning her that she had only a few moments to live and within the hour would be standing before her maker. And he kept imploring her to tell the truth as he stood there with pen and paper in hand to take down her dying statement. Grenfell says, at last her eyes were raised to the face of that man, the father of her children, the man who had sworn so shortly just to love her and honor her and protect her until death parted them. And here he was, now her murderer. And he said the silence at her bedside cuts as he waited for a reply. And as her eyes fell on those familiar features, I can only suppose that she saw him as he once had been. Evil had taken hold of him. For a new light came into her eyes, and before she died, she left with this line on her lips to save him. My God, she said, it was an accident. He did not mean that. Isn't there something in that sentiment that you love? Isn't there something in that sort of belief that you long for? I read a story of an old British chief years ago who was wrapped all around in his animal skins, and he was stepping into a baptistry to be baptized, and the young fellow who was about to administer the baptism was standing there with him, and the old chief, wrapped in those skins, turned to him and said, what about my ancestors? What's become of them? None of them were baptized as I am about to be. And the young preacher, with all of his zeal, said, they're in hell burning. The old chief looked at him for a moment and pulled his cloak around him a little tighter and stepped back out of the baptistry with the words, I believe then I'll take my chances with them. And I read that story and I thought, of course, that's not at all the thing to do. And yet, the longer you just sit and look at the page, the more you see and understand something in this man that you so admire. And I think that there's something in him that Paul would say, I understand that sentiment. I understand what you're thinking. You say, well, Jim, how could you come to that conclusion? Very simply, I read the words of Paul in the book of Romans. I would. I would if it would help. I would myself if it would help be cut off completely from Jesus Christ, if it would bring you to repentance. This loyalty to people, this devotion, this dedication, this hunger for the kind of thing that gives all of us the power to see it through. Older members in this congregation, do you realize that that is a power that you hold within your hands that you can so readily distribute to all of the rest of us who have not lived as long as you have been privileged to live? It's the case that David and Jonathan had. I hear it when I read the book of 1 Samuel. This point in his life is down and saved. His heart is literally sinking within him, and his friend Jonathan comes to him, his friend, the son of his father's bitter enemy. His father's trying to take his life, and Jonathan comes, and so says the book, he strengthened his in the Lord. And he came to him knowing, I will never have the kingdom because of you. I know that. I will never sit on my father's throne because of you. I know that. But it does not matter. And I do not care because I am for you and I love you and you are my friends. And the contrast between that kind of a friendship, and I read that, and I wonder how David could live as he sometimes came to live, having known a friend like that so early in his life, having known such purity and shamelessness and redemption in a relationship. How could David at times be so godless, so much like a God father than like a man of God so often in his life? Do you remember, for example, in 2 Samuel chapter 23, a story about David? David is in exile. He is alone in a cave, and he's just musing to himself. And in the midst of his loneliness and this down portion of his life and his depression, as he muses to himself, he says, you know, I wish I could just, if I could just have a drink of water, if I could just have one more drink from that well, it'd sort of be like some of you saying, you know, if I could just have a drink of cold water out of that well at the farm where I grew up. He's just musing. It is not a command. It's a dream. He's alone and under siege, and he's just thinking about home, and he's thinking about how I'd like to have a drink of water from home. Just a little of the joy that used to pervade my days. There were three men who heard him say this. I want you to understand, these were three friends. They were not boys. They were not youths. They were not privates. They were not foolish men on a whim. They were hardened fighting men, valiant warriors, his friends. And you read that story in 2 Samuel 23, and the Bible says they climbed down a cliff. They fought their way 7 miles across a garrison of Philistine soldiers, and I can just see them two by two and back to back fighting their way across to that well. They finally made it to the well, and one of them lowered a skin down into the well and drew it back out again filled with that water that David wanted. They fought their way 7 miles back across once again, back up the cliff, back to the cave. And they presented that skin of water to David, a sacrifice, a sign, a symbol of their loyalty and their devotion to him. And when David saw it, he said, I can't drink this. How in the world could I drink this? No man, no flesh and blood man should have this kind of loyalty and this kind of devotion. Only God should have that. And he poured the water out on the ground as a sacrifice to his God. Now you read that story and you think, wow, what a wonderful, powerful story. But you're in 2 Samuel 23, and it ends with a list of all the names of the others who had devoted themselves likewise to David. You come to understand, this isn't Israel's army. This is David's army. The most valiant, noble men who had ever fought for Israel. And do you know how the list ends? Anybody know? It ends with the name Uriah the Hittite. And man, the first time I read that, I thought, Samuel. Oh, Samuel, why did you have to put that in there after all of the noble things that you've told me about David, after all of this learning that he is the kind of man after God's own heart, the kind of man who could call hardened fighting men to him and conjure up a loyalty and a devotion in them like this, who could draw from them this kind of a response. Did you have to put that name on that list? Uriah the Hittite. husband of Bathsheba, the man whom David will soon have murdered. And Uriah came to David with the water of his devotion. David poured it out on the ground like sewer water. And you contrast between how David acted toward Uriah and how Jonathan acted toward David's. And you come to understand the difference between a redemptive relationship and something that's so devilish and selfish and awful. Friends, people get the power to see it through because some godly person will take hold of them and will not turn them loose, no matter who they are or what they've done or how they get or how ugly their life becomes. They will not betray them. They will not turn against them. For no matter how much it would serve their own selfish cause, they will not forsake them. Writer Mark Rutherford has said, "I had opportunity, I should like to add one more beatitude. Blessed is the man who gives us back our self-respect." You understand what he means. Perhaps you know, maybe you've in film, perhaps you've read it on the written page, the story of Les Miserables, the story of Jean Valjean. At first nothing, and then he becomes a hardened criminal, and he comes to town and he is cynical and embittered and negative. He would do nothing for himself. And in the story, the old bishop in the town, in kindness and in mercy, takes him in. He feeds him and he looks after him and he cares for him. And the only thanks he gets is in the middle of the night one night, Jean Valjean steals him blind, takes every single article of silver from his home, bags it up, creeps off into the... They bring him back. They throw him down in the lounges of the old bishop. They present the accusation and the evidence in front of him. He thinks for a moment, "Jean, you forgot the silver candlesticks. I'm so glad you came. Could you return?" And he takes the silver candlesticks and he places them in the bag. And the police shrug and they leave. And when they had gone, the old bishop says, "Valjean, tonight I bought your soul. You can never be bad again." And he never was. And you know what made the difference. The moral of the story was an old fellow who refused to betray him, who refused to forsake him. You know who Ross McIntyre was? Ross McIntyre was a deserter. He deserted from the Federal Army during the course of the Civil War, and as a result of that desertion, he was about to suffer the stiffest of penalties. They were going to hang him. There was a man who wrote a letter on his behalf. That letter is in the Smithsonian Institute in Washington. The man who wrote the letter was a man by the name of Abraham Lincoln. The letter reads, "Ross McIntyre is a good man. He promises me that if we give him another chance, he will never, ever run away again." You know where they found Ross McIntyre. They found him in the middle of one of the hottest spots of a Civil War battle, dead, with that letter still inside his coat pockets. It's the idea that when people insist upon believing in us, it makes the difference. When we have regained our respect, and in it we find those examples and illustrations, and give you all to say to you, my quintessential picture. It's the picture of what he has done in your life. It's the picture of John 20, sitting on the beach. They're eating dinner. You remember that scene? And once they finish, perhaps a walk down through there, and Jesus, in the midst of that discussion, turns to Peter and says, "Peter, do you love me?" Peter says, "Yes, Lord, I love you." Jesus says, "Then feed my sheep." And they go a little further, and I don't know, but I sort of picture perhaps Jesus taking him by the shoulders and looking into his eyes and saying, "Peter, do you love me?" And the response is, Lord, you know I love you. Then feed my sheep. Just a little farther down the line, he turns to him one more time and says, Peter, do you love me? John in chapter 21 says, because he asked him three times, Peter hurt. Three's Peter's number, isn't it? Three's his number. And his number is up. See, he knew Jesus predicted he would do it. He knew it. He even knew when he did it that Jesus turned and looked straight into his eyes. But maybe at that point, he's still not sure that Jesus actually knows that he did it. He knows in John 21, Peter, do you love me? Three times. And you remember his response? His response was, Lord, you know everything. And then comes the commission. Then comes the commission. You need to feed my sheep. You need to take care of my flock. I ask you, was there anyone in the Jewish nation ever affected more by anyone save Jesus Christ more than they were by Peter? And you know what made the difference in his life. It was a Lord who refused to give up on him, who refused to cast him aside, who refused to hand him over to Satan, who actually gave back to him his self-respect, gave back to him all the power he would need to see it through the rest of his days. And you know, if you read this book, it's a litany of stories as he gave it back to fishermen, tax collectors, prostitutes, thieves, murderers. It took Jesus to see the good. It took Jesus to give back that self-respect. And as you look in the mirror on a daily basis and you consider your own life, this physical journey that you are now on, isn't that exactly the way it was with you? Because Jesus gives to you and extends to you a loyalty that you know you don't deserve. He gives you the power to survive. He gives you the power to beat sin. And it comes through a redemptive relationship of the greatest lover of all times, who knows you better than you will ever know yourself, and who has said to you, I believe in you, I love you, and I came to redeem you and release you and save you from all of this. I came to claim you for eternity. And you see, the ones who believe that, the ones who accept him and start living for him, start doing that for each other. They choose to share in the joy, and they choose to share in the sufferings of one another, and they won't give up, and they do it because of Christ. Friends, behind all of your selfishness, behind all of your shortcomings, behind all of your failures, do you understand Jesus sees what you can be, and he credits that to you? I think about a passage in Hebrews chapter 6 and verse 10 that says, God is not unfair. God is not unjust. He knows what you've been through. He knows what you've been through. And so let me close just with one more story. Perhaps you've read or seen in film the story of May Lemke, a little woman about 4 feet 6 inches tall, weighed just about 90 pounds. She was called to Milwaukee General Hospital because they had a 6-month-old infant there who was born mentally retarded, who also had cerebral palsy. The child was blind, a vegetable, totally unresponsive to touch and sound, abandoned by the mother. They did not know what to do with him until someone thought of the name of a little nurse in England, and so they called her. And the request was very simple. We were wondering if you could care for him until he dies. And she said, if I take him, he will most certainly not die. And so she began to care for him and sing to him and talk to him and to massage his arms and legs and his fingers and toes. She sang to him all the time. And I mean literally year after year, scores of years. with no smile, no tears, no sound, no movement ever coming from him. And she worked all the harder and prayed all the harder and cried a million tears and never quit. And when she would weep, she would take his hands and take his fingers and run them down her cheeks. And she would say, "Leslie, can you feel this? I'm sad now. I'm crying." She refused to see him as a burden. She would write later, she wrote about his life, "I did not seek Leslie, so there was a reason God gave him to me. I was never reluctant to take him out into public. I loved him dearly." She even told the story of having him out on a bus one afternoon, and perhaps he was making some sort of noise, and there was a woman on the bus who turned around and snapped at her and said, "Why don't you just put him in an institution? You're wasting your life." And she would write, "I snapped back, 'You're the one who's wasting your life.'" She tried and tried to help him walk, and he couldn't walk, and she would stand him with those gnarled, twisted fingers in a chain-link fence every day just to get him to stand. And before long, he could crawl just a little. On his 18th birthday, he just tottered about 3 or 4 steps. And so she went and bought an old broken-down piano, brought it into the house, and began to take his hands and his fingers and just bang out sound on the keyboard, played music, played the phonograph, played the radio every day, day and night, hoping it would stimulate him. And one night in the middle of winter 1971, she and her husband awoke to music. It was Tchaikovsky's Piano Concerto No. 1. She said to her husband, "You leave the radio on?" And he said, "No, I don't think so." And so they got up from the bed and they crept into the living room and they found Leslie, that big hulking boy of theirs, sitting on the bench, smile plastered on his face, playing that classical piece with remarkable accuracy. Maybe you've seen him. He still travels all over the world and can play the greatest pieces written by all of the masters. You know what made the difference for him? 4'6", 90-pound woman who just would not turn him loose. Now, friends, that is the picture. That is the picture of our Redeemer, of our rescue, Jesus Christ, who will not let you go. And I'm going to tell you, you will never, ever, ever find the power you need to live this life successfully, to see it through from the beginning to the end as He intends for you to do, without the blood of Jesus Christ. You think on those things this week, would you? And we'll continue this discussion next Sunday. If you need to make a response to the Son of God today, it's why we sing this song and offer the invitation each and every time we are together. Blood of the Son of God, His unspeakable gift, the power that you need to see it through in your life. If you've never obeyed the gospel, and we invite you to make that decision this morning. Let's stand together.